Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
Hey, friends and family of Sex with Simmery. We are so grateful to have your listenership. We have the coolest fans in the world. It's pretty much the best. And we hope that the love is mutual. If you are interested in supporting the Sex with Simmery media, either the website, the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/sexwithsimmery and become a supporter. For as little as $1 a month, you can be a regular supporter and continue to bring independent media that provides the kind of information that you want to have out in the world. Over here at Sex with Simmery, we have been doing this stuff for years. As you've noticed, we've got over 200 episodes. The Sex with Simmery website has been up since 2008. We've been giving you the goods for absolutely no cost, and we will continue to do so as long as we can. So thank you so much for your listenership, and we do hope that you will check it out. Patreon.com/sexwithsimmery. Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Timmery. I'm super duper excited, as you probably guessed, for our next guest. For today's guest, this is someone who we're going to talk about what she does for a living. We're probably going to talk about her as a person. And at some point, I'm just going to go, you're fascinating. You're just fascinating. Because I already, like, we were sitting here in the studio and we're just talking about, like, pre-gaming stuff. And I was like, oh, this is going to be great. So everybody get real excited to meet Galia Goodell. How are you doing?
I'm absolutely great. Thank you for asking.
So I'm going to make sure that I get your title correct because it's very cool. Sexual behavioral specialist for adults with intellectual disabilities.
That is what I do. That's my job.
Yeah. Okay. So let's break that down.
Right.
What the fuck do you do?
So I work as a consultant specifically, mostly one-on-one with adults with intellectual disabilities who are part of the system of adults with disabilities who have staff and they have support and they have behavior plans and individualized service plans. And part of that involved some staff member at some point looking at this client or talking to their team and going, this person needs behavioral help. And as a sidebar, so there's a big difference between behavioral help and therapy. Behavioral help is very much focused on, behavioral work is focused on the actions that a person is taking and the behaviors that they're exhibiting. So I'm not here to, I don't work as a therapist. I'm not there to hear their problems necessarily, although I will mention later that I absolutely do that also. But I am here officially, and the way I get my funding is to help change their behavior to be less maladaptive, less problematic to them, less harmful to themselves.
So in a more specific way, like, who are the types of folks you work with? Like, what would be like a situation, a diagnosis where someone would bring you in?
Right. So I specifically am qualified to do sexuality work. I do some general behavioral stuff also, but the clients where I am specifically brought in is for sexuality work. So I might have a client who has a long-term boyfriend, but they're on again, off again. And whenever they're broken up, she goes on binges of meeting men off chat lines and having unprotected sex. And her staff would like that to stop. They'd like her to stop having unprotected sex. They'd like her to stop eloping because when she goes off to do this, they don't have eyes on her and something unsafe could be happening. Because these are all adults with disabilities who have in their ISPs, in their individualized service plans, how long they're allowed to be alone. So some of them are allowed to be, I don't think anyone I work with is never allowed to be alone ever. Some of them can go off and do whatever they want for the whole day. They can get themselves to their day program. Some of them need to be supervised all the time unless maybe they're in their home. And if they're only allowed to be alone in their home for an hour at a time or so. So there's sort of a lot of safety concerns with these adults, and they make unsafe choices, or they make choices that are unsafe for other people. Another one of my clients likes going to the gym and is an adult and should be allowed to go to the gym, but also makes inappropriate comments towards women when he goes to the gym. So I'm here to help him change some of those behaviors and maybe have a healthier, better relationship with his girlfriend, so he'll feel less inclined to make those kinds of comments.
I'm filled with questions. Great. Not the least of which is, like, how does someone end up with this level of supervision where someone gets to decide how many hours a day they're allowed to be alone? That would be my first thought. And second, can you work with literally everyone? Can you stop everybody who's being a dick at the gym?
Okay, that's mostly a joke. So the way that these services are chosen for clients or consumers, there's a lot of different language. I think a social worker would, in fact, know a little bit more about this. I don't have a social work background. I have an education background. But as far as I've picked up and has been explained to me, there are huge teams that work with every one of my clients. And probably they were identified for services when they were back in elementary school, when someone noticed that there was a cognitive delay back when they were very young. And they came into the disability system at that point. So they probably have had a social worker or a support coordinator that entire time, making sure they get the help that they need in a number of different ways. So for example, there are two places, in the broadest sense of the picture, there are two places that an adult with an intellectual disability can live, either with their family or in a supported living environment. Now, there are 12 different kinds of supported living environments. If they live with their families, there is less of that kind of restriction because their families really get to sort of decide what they do. If they live in a housing situation with staff, there are rules for when the staff can leave and when the staff have to be there. And so the reason we have those guidelines for how long consumers can be left alone by themselves or how much time they should spend in the community or what their staffing ratio is kind of a little bit more for the staff members to give them guidelines for what they should be doing with their clients.
All right. So I'm going to just leap ahead a little bit.
Great.
Right. And go immediately to the fact that we have a lot of conversations in the culture at large about who is sexual and who is not sexual. And we kind of just skip people with all disabilities in general, but then we get this extra sticky wicket if it's intellectual in nature.
Yes. Something that's really important to remember, and this is something that, so I've got a degree at Widener, as you know, and something that was really taught in all of my classes is that we are sexual people from when we are born until we die. That doesn't mean that people necessarily want to have sex or aren't asexual or any of those categories in there, but we will always have a relationship with sexuality, no matter what our cognitive ability is. So these people that have cognitive disabilities have gone through the same puberty as neurotypical people have gone through. They have similar sexual urges, and are just as interested statistically and broadly in having sex as anybody else is. Now, there are a lot of barriers there. Most people who have intellectual disabilities especially, but all disabilities, are, I believe, 300 times more likely to be abused by a caretaker because you're in these positions where another person is making decisions for you, is touching your body sometimes if you need care, if you need help caring for yourself or performing personal hygiene or any of those tasks. If you have a physical disability, it's someone who might be lifting you up or manipulating your body. If you have an intellectual disability, you might need assistance performing simple tasks. And so the boundary between abuse and care is already fairly a fine line in these situations. And it's very difficult, especially for people with intellectual disabilities, to draw a line of consent in the sand to say, well, it was okay with me when you helped me clean up after a shower, but it's not okay now that you're touching my vulva recreationally. There's not always so much of a line. And so we end up trying to shut that abuse down by being very specific, like, no, you may not touch the genitals or the erogenous zones of someone who has a disability. That's abuse. But it's not always abuse because people with disabilities can actually consent to having sex. It is a little bit trickier to get consent and to ascertain what counts as consenting sex and healthy sex, but it's there and we can find it.
So one of the conversations that invariably arises when we're talking about, usually it's like campus mm-hmm. rape or something like that. And then like somebody wants to chime in with how drunkenness affects consent. Now, drunkenness is different, obviously, because first of all, it's theoretically a temporary state and a person who could consent at a different point in that day. But it does sort of raise some of those questions about when you are impaired in some way. Do we just like say, nah, like cannot give consent under any circumstances? And is even bringing up that comparison like inherently problematic.
There are definitely problems with that comparison because it is, I think, less in the specific bare bones of drunkenness versus intellectual disability. They're both cognitive states that we would not consider able to consent to a number of complicated things, but also just because of the conversations we have around them. We as a culture, especially as part of consent culture, spend a lot of time saying, you know, drunkenness equals cannot consent. And so because we have that as a fact on the table, it therefore makes the comparison problematic because we don't want to say someone with a disability can't consent. What we want to say is, how can we get consent? How can we make sure that the consent is, what's Fry's, freely given, reversible, informed, enthusiastic, and specific? What does that, so that's from Planned Parenthood, by the way. Planned Parenthood, I think, came up with that acronym for Fry's, and that's the kind of consent that you want to get. How can we channel that into a conversation with someone who has a disability that may not always understand ramifications? So, for example, the I in Fry's is informed. What does informed look like when you can't really make a medical decision on your own? How can you give informed consent to sex when you don't necessarily know all of the information about the consequences like STIs or pregnancy? Or emotional ramifications, you might not be aware that those are coming. And so one of the things that I do in my job, first of all, is education. I try to make sure that my clients are as informed as possible on what consequences can be for sex and also what joys can come from sex. So one of my clients a few weeks ago has an IUD. By the way, a lot of women with intellectual disabilities have IUDs because, or the implant, because it's honestly the easiest thing for their caretaker or their staff members to make sure that they're not going to get pregnant.
Hell, it's the best form of birth control for a lot of women.
Yes, like, although there are ethical ramifications or ethical concerns because a lot of my clients want to have kids. They say, I want to have a baby. And now, honestly, they probably can't take care of a baby. So we give them, well, not we, but their staff members or their parents or their caretakers choose that they get an IUD. That's how we're going to make sure they don't get pregnant. But why do we get to say that they don't get pregnant? This is an adult human being in their 30s or 40s who says they want to have a baby. So this isn't an easy answer. Mm-hmm. I don't have the answer. Nobody, I think, thinks that it's as black and white as it could be. So although I would agree, the best way to make sure that you're not going to get pregnant, it's no fuss, it's no hassle for people who have trouble remembering to take their medications or have trouble knowing how to use a condom, perhaps, or other forms of barrier contraception. It's the best way to make sure you don't have a baby. But who's a staff member or a caretaker to say you, an adult human being, is not permitted to get pregnant? There's a lot of eugenics in there. That is a conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna be just completely frank that, like, my personal feels here, and I'm imagining that there are other people listening who are just having some personal feels right now, which is like, I don't think the planet needs an unlimited number of babies, especially ones that, like, would require a team to help with. Because, like, if somebody can't, like, it's hard enough to raise kids if you are in all of the ways that society, you know, registers a competent adult, whatever that means, like, it's hard enough. So, like, we don't have systems in place for the average parent. We don't have, like, a system where you suddenly get sent that baby box. So you just had your baby and it's got, you know, like, supplies you need in it. And like information on how to take care of an infant. Like, there's so minimal resources for the average family, much less somebody who needs help on their own. And so my gut instinct is like, honestly, if you're in a position where you can't take care of yourself, I kind of not mad about somebody just like, baby, nah. Like, nah. And that's just my gut. Like, so philosophically, we could argue about it, though.
The ideal response to that, I think, would be bringing in a sexuality educator who is trained to work with people with intellectual disabilities. Hi. And work with that client specifically to get them to possibly change their mind or find other ways to fulfill those needs. Okay. So the client that I was mentioning who elopes sometimes and has sex with strangers and gets a lot of STIs has an IUD and told me the other week that she wants to take it out. She doesn't want it anymore because it's poking her boyfriend when they have intercourse. And also she wants to have a baby because she wanted him to be closer to her. She thought that having a baby would solve their relationship problems and turn their on-again, off-again relationship into a stable, long-term relationship.
Oh, good.
Right. So what we did is we spent a lot of time talking about why that wasn't a great idea. why that wouldn't repair their relationship, why, what it could do to her body. This client smokes marijuana recreationally, so I'm a giant nerd about neuroscience, and she likes when people talk to her like an adult. So I told her about the endocannabinoid system and why she would have to quit smoking marijuana if she wanted to get pregnant, and just a number of other ramifications. She'd have to lose a lot of weight, she'd have to change her lifestyle, nothing that she wanted to do, and that if she wanted to have someone to care for and something to make her relationship with her partner stronger, maybe she should spend more time with his other children that he already has and make a family that way. So the ideal situation is not to coerce someone into not getting pregnant by tricking them or forcing them into having birth control, but instead to work with them and help them to get their needs met in other ways and to understand why that's not the best plan.
I mean, I want you to do this work with everyone. I'm just like sitting here, I'm like, I don't know who's funding this, but like, can they fund this for everyone?
It would be delightful if I had that kind of time.
Like, if everyone had someone to sit down with them and be like, all right, so what are your life goals? And then like have a discussion on like, well, are your current behaviors going to lead to that outcome? And like, realistically, what sort of stuff do you have to set up in order for that to, you know, like, if we actually gave this kind of time and attention to romantic and sexual decisions in general, like, the number of people who are like, well, my marriage isn't going very well, but we're going to have a baby, and that's going to bring us closer together.
Oh, dear.
And it's like, I mean, it might. It very well might. But what we know is going to do is do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
So, like, are you ready for X, Y, and Z? Because those are the things we know will happen.
Yeah. So I try to have really frank conversations with that. Another one of my clients says he doesn't want to use a condom with his girlfriend because it doesn't feel as good. And so we go, okay, but you know, you've got this great life right now where you get to just sit at home all day, which has enough complicated ramifications. But you know, he doesn't need to have a job. And we remind him, like, okay, but if you get your girlfriend pregnant, you're going to have to get a job. Here's what's going to happen when you have a kid. You're going to have to care this much about taking care of another human being. Your girlfriend has her own support team and sometimes can't go on dates with you because she has problematic behaviors. Do you think she's ready to be a mother? And so having those kinds of conversations with him hopefully helps. I mean, I can't monitor him in the bedroom. All I can do is give him the tools to make choices. Although, humorous anecdote about this client, occasionally when I go see him, he tells me he forgets how to put a condom on because he's a very sexual middle-aged man and just likes watching me touch a phallic object. Mm. And so wants me to demonstrate how to put a condom on because he's forgotten. I'm making air quotes over here. So I just started bringing kind of unpleasant-looking phallic-shaped objects to demonstrate how to put a condom on. And once the phallic-shaped object started looking especially unpleasant, he told me he remembered how.
What's
every time.
Unpleasant looking?
Just a really ugly carrot. Like, I found the most hideous carrot I could at the farmer's market.
I like it. So this actually leads me to another question. So I can't really go into why I've had this conversation with people lately, but on why it is possible for someone with an intellectual disability to be still predatory, that whether, so here's another way to enter this conversation is, earlier today I saw someone post a video, and it was about two people with Down syndrome who were in a relationship, and the title that someone had put on this was "The Most Innocent Type of Love," and I went,
no.
Because, well, first of all, the word innocent is sort of like,
it's so desexualizing. People spend so much time either desexualizing or hypersexualizing people with disabilities. Either they say, oh, they're a sweet, innocent angel. They're like a child. They couldn't possibly be sexual. Or they say, well, they don't know any better and all they think about is sex and they're inappropriate and they make inappropriate actions. So there's this huge dichotomy in how people speak about the sexuality of people with intellectual disabilities. And none of it is, oh, people with intellectual disabilities run the exact same gamut with just perhaps a few more support needs when it comes to sexuality.
So, yeah, I mean, is this basically just our own discomfort, like the neurotypical person's discomfort with talking about sex in general, much less when you make it more complicated? Because, like, people don't want to talk about sexuality with kids either, you know, regardless of where they fall in intellectual or physical capabilities, whatever. It's just like, I don't feel comfortable talking about this, so let's just not.
I think it is a lot of overlapping circles in this Venn diagram of discomfort. We're uncomfortable talking about sexuality. We are uncomfortable talking about the sexuality of people with intellectual disabilities, and we're uncomfortable interacting with people who have disabilities. A lot of people don't want to talk to folks who have disabilities or cut the conversation off as soon as possible for a number of reasons, mostly stemming around fear of like, oh God, could that happen to somebody in my life, or discomfort? Like, this isn't the kind of conversation I'm used to having. I don't like it anymore. And so when you overlap all of those circles onto this point of a person with a disability, so we have this fear of this could happen to someone that we love, or someone we love could have a disability, and worries about consent, which is a national conversation that's happening more recently, which I'm pretty happy about, and the fear of sexuality and intellectual disability going together, either the hypersexualized or the asexualized concept of it, suddenly we don't want to talk about it and we don't want to address it. And so we push it off in either direction as we can. I'm gesturing broadly to either side. In either direction, either by saying, no, these people don't have sex, I never want to talk about it. How dare you suggest that these people have lusts and arousal and libido and sexual desires? Or we say they can't control themselves, I'd better shut it down altogether. This person can't control their sexual behavior, I need to put a moratorium on their actions altogether.
And then I wonder how the education for someone with an intellectual disability around consent differs from how we teach this stuff, like, more broadly. How we teach it in, like, school. Like, is there a substantive difference in the way that you would approach these conversations?
Yes. There is less nuance. A lot of folks with intellectual disabilities cannot grasp abstract thoughts, so I want to give them very clear action flowcharts. When we're working with typical students, neurotypical students, we might say, oh, you know, read the room, see how they're feeling, touch their wrist and see if they reciprocate. Here are flirting actions and sort of, I mean, we're not actually coaching students how to flirt, unfortunately, but we should be teaching them how to read body language and to have conversations about consent slowly over time and building things. Whereas when I'm working with clients who don't have the concept to think abstractly, I wouldn't say, are they making a lot of eye contact? Did they ask to spend more time with you? Did they bring up previous partners? Are they talking about things they like in bed? These aren't easy conversation topics that are necessarily going to flow with all of my clients. Some of them will, by the way. I work with a lot of clients who have high cognitive ability and can understand this kind of nuance. But others of them, I will say, okay, if you want to have sex with somebody, you should say to the person you want to have sex with, I like you. Can I kiss you? And if they say no, you walk away and you don't talk to them unless they initiate it again. Mm-hmm. If they say yes, then you ask them how they want to be kissed. If they say maybe, then you start a conversation about it. And here's what that conversation looks like. And we just provide essentially flowchart after flowchart after flowchart, mapping out social scripts to make sure that consent and desire are accounted for.
In the event that the partner is neurotypical, how does that change how you navigate consent? Because, I mean, is that, like, comparable in, like, a power differential?
Absolutely.
That, like, is that a thing that can be done, like, safely and with taking care of everyone's needs?
Yes. Something that I would question. So with a couple of my clients, I talk with their partners as well. And something that I would want to ascertain and have ascertained in the past when my disabled client is talking with a neurotypical is dating a neurotypical person, is why is that person dating my client? Do they think they're fun? Do they think they're engaging? Because my clients are fun, engaging people. They're marvelous human beings. Do they want to date my client for all the reasons that I would want anyone to date somebody else? If so, great. I'll keep an eye out to make sure there's not advantage being taken. But as long as there's the same care and love that I would like to see in any relationship, I have no problem with it. If I ask my client's partner what they see in my client, and they have trouble answering, or I notice from talking to my client that there's a lot of advantage being taken. So, for example, one of my clients gets her allowance twice a week. She gets $10 twice a week. She gets $20 a week. And she immediately goes to her boyfriend's house and gives it to him. He doesn't say that she has to, but she feels like she should to keep him interested. And that raises a lot of red flags. Is that why he's in a relationship with her? Honestly, in this case, probably not. It's $20 a week. I don't think he's dating her for $20 a week. But I think in the past, she's had to give people money for them to be interested in her. And so she feels like she has to do that again. And so I want to ask a lot of questions about what are each of them getting out of the relationship? Is my client being appropriately cared for? Is my client being coerced into doing things they're not interested in doing? Is my client's partner getting a rewarding relationship out of my client, or are they just available sex? It's sort of a more nuanced view. I have to have a lot of conversations with my client, with their partner, with their staff members to see what I think the situation is. And now, mind you, sometimes the situation is manipulative and there's nothing I can do about that. I can't tell my client to stop dating somebody. I can't do that. They're an adult and they get to make their own choices, even if I feel like they're being manipulated. But what I can do is advise their staff to place some careful restrictions. So, for example, another of my clients, a disabled woman, was dating a non-disabled man, and he spent all of his time at her apartment and ate all her food that her money was paying for, the groceries that she bought. And so we tried to make a small change that he couldn't stay past 10 p.m. for safety reasons, also because he was disrespecting some of her staff, but also to, like, make sure he had a life of his own and he wasn't just relying on her disability and Social Security to pay for everything that he ate and all the things that he did. So we try to make small decisions. It's tough. I'm caught even now because I feel conflicted whenever I have one of these conversations, but we try to make choices that will protect our clients without sacrificing their autonomy. And again, I just want to be sort of clear. I come in as a behavioralist. So I'm here to try to change maladaptive or dangerous behaviors. I can't make choices for them. And because I'm generally the only person in my clients' lives who will talk about sex, I sort of end up acting as a sex therapist as well. And a lot of them call me a sex therapist, even though I'm not, but it's not productive for me to correct them every time they say therapist. Again, they're concrete people. If I say, no, I'm a behavioralist, that's okay. Well, then what do you do for me? So when they call me a therapist, I'm not going to argue. And I end up sort of fulfilling that role. But on paper, and what I get funding to do is to help them make choices or to help their staff interact with them in behaviorally safe ways.
I'm immediately curious about what the characteristics of people who do your job are. Like, what draws someone to the... This is a very specific job.
It's extremely niche. I tell people about it and they're like, I beg your pardon? How wide is your audience?
Yeah. So, like, what are the characteristics that make someone good at your job? What should someone know? Definitely not good at this job.
So for being someone who works in sexuality and in disability education, you have to be really passionate about both of those fields in close to equal amounts. So you need to be very comfortable talking about sex. You need to be comfortable talking about sexuality and maybe things that seem uncomfortable. You've got to talk about biology and human dynamics and all of the things that come with sexuality. I'm sure listeners of your podcast are well aware of the breadth of that topic. So you need to be really okay with answering questions as they come, not necessarily showing discomfort on your face, etc., just like you would in any classroom, any sex education classroom. And you also have to be passionate about disability education, or you might come at this from a social work background. So working clinically with people with disabilities, which involves patience and clarity and concrete communication and consistency, is like extremely important. So you sort of have to hit both of these big buzzers in order to fit in this niche market. I only know two other people doing it, and they came from totally different backgrounds from me and from each other. Everyone seems to approach it in a different way.
So how'd you get here?
That's such an exciting question. So I have always been a sex nerd. My parents, thankfully, well, my mother especially, was very open about sex. I remember in kindergarten, I knew what artificial insemination was because there was a boy in my class who had two mommies, and I was like, how does that work? You told me you need a penis and a vagina. And she was like, all right, well, let's talk about turkey basters. And so I knew a lot about sex. My mother always talked to me about sex. Absolutely fantastic. I love her. And I would read books on sex. And I got to, well, I was originally going to study opera. I was going to college. I was auditioning, tried to get into all these conservatories, and I didn't get any scholarship money. So I went to community college for 2 years to figure out what to do next. And I took a human sexuality course with, it ended up having two teachers, Seneca Gordon and Dr. Justine Shuey. Both wonderful sexologists that I respect and sex educators. And
why didn't I represent?
Heck yeah. and it honestly wasn't that I learned anything new in the class, because I had done so much reading on sex on my own. Honestly, I ended up giving sort of guest lecture-y things in my own class about things like kink and polyamory as active practitioners in those sort of subgroups. And the teacher was like, okay, great. I'm not a part of the subgroups. Why don't you talk about your experiences with the class? So, sorry, I got off track.
We're going to come back to that. Don't worry.
So it's not that I learned anything new in the class, but what was so mind-boggling to me was that these people in my class, ages 18 through 68, didn't have all this information that I considered common knowledge. And, you know, we did a thing on contraceptives, and I was like, oh, yeah, all these contraceptives. And people in my group were like, what's an IUD? And it's sort of this light bulb went off over my head that I was like, I need to fix this. There can't be people in their 50s not knowing how their own body works. So I asked Dr. Shuey, I said, how can I do this? How can I teach sex education? And she said, you're in luck. Widener is a 45-minute drive that way. So from undergrad, I knew what I wanted to do. I sort of passed the next 4 years by as quickly as I could just to get to grad school. And in those 4 years, I had another realization, sort of the disability half of the equation. My younger sister has a lot of intellectual disabilities. She's 21 now. She's a spitfire and a great human being. And we both went through the same school system, the same high school. And this high school is a wonderful liberal high school that has a fantastic comprehensive sex education program where I learned a lot as a teenager. And my sister got way, way less out of it. She sat through the same classes as I did with the same teacher and had questions unanswered. Her life experiences were different than those of her peers, of her neurotypical peers, and she simply needed more. She needed more assistance, more help, more information, differently structured information. And it made me realize that there was this huge gap that most of my peers at Widener were very excited about teaching sex education. I mean, mind you, in a huge, broad variety of ways, but it was mostly to people who... to neurotypical people. That's the expected audience. When you think of a classroom, you think of a classroom full of typically developed students.
I think we all want to work with people who we think we are like them.
Yes. Yeah. And after having these conversations with my sister, and she'd text me all of these questions like, why does my clitoris do this when I'm feeling aroused? Or why do I sweat when I'm coming? And I was like, gosh, those are really great questions that most people would ask their peers or look it up online, and you need very carefully structured answers from someone who knows you and knows how you learn. And so that made me realize that what I really wanted to do was disability education and sexuality education. And that's how I hit this. And I didn't really have a clear goal for what kind of career I would do that in. I thought I might teach in a special ed classroom somewhere. And then one of my professors, my final year at Widener, my now boss reached out to him and said, hey, do you know anybody who would fit this bill, who would, you know, one of your Widener grads who's a sexuality specialist who could also work with adults with disabilities? And I was one of three people that they reached out to, and I had a really exciting interview where I felt very sort of, I felt very delighted by the work that they wanted to do and how they wanted it done. There's a huge variety of behavioral work that can be done for adults with disabilities, and some of it borders on abusive and some of it borders on very helpful. And the company, the group that I work for, believes very strongly in the autonomy of our clients and not making decisions for the convenience of their staff, and just a number of other things I felt excited about. So I jumped right into working with them.
How prevalent are these kind of services? I feel like this is a pretty miraculous thing that's happening, and I feel like this is probably pretty rare.
I don't know exactly how rare it is. I do know that I have more clients than I have time for, and I get another email every week saying, do you have time for this client? And I try to fit them in. I've got about, I think, 10 clients right now, which doesn't seem like very many, but I also have a 9-to-5. I've got a unrelated to sexuality full-time job. So I know that I constantly have more people needing my services. And also a couple of people who have been in the field longer than I have made casual jokes like, well, if you ever decide to stop working for your current company, don't worry, you'll get snatched up fast. So I have a feeling it's not very common based on those bits of information.
Yeah. I mean, the folks that I know that work with disabled populations that aren't in sexuality, like when they hit me up, it's very often like, yo, we don't have any resources for this particular mm-hmm. thing. Like, my job is probably, you know, like, not, I'm not trained in that, but this comes up a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there's very, very few resources that I personally know of that I can send to people. And so that's partly because, like, that's not my area. But also, like, my understanding is if they're working in the field and they're coming to me, odds are good there's not, like, a ton of training for right. someone, you know, who are caregivers, who are working in, like, a residential situation. Like,
it also happens to be that most staff members in these programs have a GED and not a college diploma. And I'm not saying the specialists. The specialists often have social work degrees, et cetera. But the folks that are just sitting at home acting as caretakers, spending the majority of time with their clients, don't have as much comprehensive sex education as at least someone, definitely someone from Widener, but even somebody coming from, you know, a freshman 101 human sexuality course. Mm. So they are just passing on the same information that their parents gave them or that they learned from their peers. Mm. And so there is really a need for specialization in a number of places. And because people neglect sexuality when it comes to people with disabilities, they forget that a specialist is necessary there and they honestly don't bring me in until there's a problem. Which makes sense. Again, I'm a behavioralist. I'm not here just to sort of act as general support staff. I come in to fix something. Thankfully, there are sort of ways of gaming the system, saying, oh, this person has these maladaptive behaviors. They need someone to change their behavior. So, for example, I have a client who her maladaptive behaviors include unsafe interactions on the internet. She'll, like, send people money because she thinks that they're in a relationship. And they were able to bring me in to sort of help with the behaviors that she's exhibiting when what she really needs is someone to talk to about sex and to find her a queer social circle. And so that's the work that I end up doing under the sort of guise of behavioral work. She won't need to send people money on the internet when she has friends in real life. Mm-hmm. So I can address the behavior in any way that I see and her team sees appropriate. And so I see the way to stop her unsafe behaviors as to find her a better social circle where she won't have to just find people on the internet and trust them blindly and be manipulated, and instead find her actual good people in life to interact with. So I can sort of address these behaviors however I need to.
I love it. So I'm going to do like a 90, 100 degree turn real fast. I just want to mention the fact, can we talk about the fact you've been on this show before?
I certainly have.
Do you want to talk about how you've been on this show?
I would
show
be
before?
Delighted to. Several months ago at this point during the Philadelphia Podcast Festival, is that what it was called?
Yes, Nathan Karun is the founder and producer.
Oh my gosh, that's so great. You had as a special guest on your show the amazing Goddess Thane, who is a Philadelphia pro dominatrix and also a longtime friend of mine. And she put a call out online saying that she needed a demo bottom for this live broadcast. She was going to demonstrate to your audience what physical domination and topping can look like. And I have interacted with her in the kink scene in the past and know and trust her a lot and said that I was happy to. So I came to the Ruba Club in my underwear and pasties and was flogged and scratched and hit on stage for the benefit of your audience.
And how is that for you?
I mean, it was delightful. I always enjoy those activities.
So this is, again, this is, let's, we changed topic. What does kink mean for your life? What does it mean for you?
Oh boy, that is a very complicated question with a lot of different answers. Let me see if I can find, it used to mean, when I first got into kink, when I first met Goddess Thane and a number of other people who are now very dear to me, kink was a very important mental health tool for me. I lived with my parents. I'm a sort of control freak person. I didn't feel like I had enough control over my life. I didn't have close friends that I got to see every day. My friends were people that I only could see at conventions every few months. And I felt like I was sort of untethered. And kink was this very tangible way of giving me control by giving someone else control. You might have picked up that I consider myself, I'm a submissive and a bottom. And by giving someone that I trusted control over my actions, I no longer had to think and worry. I got to just turn my brain off. And that was so valuable to me for a very long time in my life. It so happens that really joyfully, I'm in this beautiful place in my life right now. I live with an amazing polyamorous family. I'm supported. I love my job. I have this easy control over all the things that I want. It's kind of idyllic and terrifying. I'm afraid it's going to all disappear. but I no longer need kink for my mental health. And now it is a lot more of an exciting recreation activity. So it's still fun. It's still something I want to do frequently. But it's like a board game night for me. I'm like, oh, why don't I interact with people that I love in this cool intellectually and physically stimulating way?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up recreation because there's the researchers out of Indiana who are trying to have it reclassified to have like BDSM interest taken from being like a diagnostic category to literally described as a recreational activity. Because in their interviews with folks about what do you get out of it, the answers are not dissimilar from what people get out of like sports.
Right.
So.
I love that. I don't think I've heard that bit of research conversation, but I love it because to consider it a diagnosis is to pathologize it. And I'm not a fan of pathologizing things that are healthy when done correctly. Mind you, there are a lot of ways that BDSM can be extremely unhealthy for people and can be taken in manipulative and inappropriate ways and can be used to mess with people's mental health. But that's not the core of it. The core of it is an activity that you engage in with yourself or with other people to make you feel happy or good. So I
mean, you can do anything wrong.
Sure. I mean, exactly. You can do sports wrong. And you could totally hurt yourself.
You could put a fork in the microwave, you know?
Oh, like, that sounds like a terrible but very interesting idea.
Right? I'm just saying, like, the science out of it, right? Like, you just... Okay. That was a one American of, Hustle reference. Okay.
Oh, all right. No references.
Let's hide over here. Okay. You should see American Hustle. I'm just saying.
What is it, a movie?
Yeah. It's got Christian Bale. It's got Jennifer Lawrence. And it's got...
Christian Bale is Batman, right?
He was at one point, yes.
Okay.
And forever in my heart as Batman, because Ben Affleck can fuck all the way off. Yeah.
Okay. The only one that I remember as Batman is Michael Keaton, who played Dogberry in Much Ado About Nothing.
Well, this has taken a turn.
I'm sorry. I just get really excited when I possibly
and
no
next
references.
Next on Batman with Timmy, where we discuss our favorite Batmans.
I'll be honest, I don't know if I've ever seen a Batman movie.
My favorite Batman is definitely Christian Bale, and the rest of the movies are, like, just, you know, either the lead up to that, they were building so Christopher Nolan could take over. Yeah, that's basically how it exists in my brain.
Back to Sex with Timmery.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So another thing we were discussing before we started recording and was about your life. And you've already mentioned a little bit about how kink exists in your life and how you live with your polycule. I'm not sure of the exact orientation of it, but also just how you are figuring out your own sexual orientation in terms of where you fall on the... What is the name for the... I guess it's like hypered A scale. Like, I guess it's like the red-purple scale.
Oh, yeah.
Is our closest to terminology for it right now. What's that exploration like for you right now?
Oh, boy. It's been very interesting. So for a very long time when I was younger, I had a lot of sex that I didn't want to have, which isn't to say that I didn't consent to it or I didn't enjoy it, but it felt like the thing I needed to do at the time because my partner wanted to have sex and I was enjoying making out with them. And it seemed like the next step was to have sex. And so we did it and it felt good. And there were possibly orgasms involved and everything was great. And I have realized in recent years that outside of the new relationship energy period, NRE being like when you first meet someone, you're very excited about them and you have all this adrenaline and delight. And that's generally when I'm like, oh, I would love to have sex with you. This seems delightful. But outside of that period, I wasn't really getting turned on with partners. I wasn't experiencing physical arousal, even if I wanted to. Even if I got into bed with somebody that I found very attractive and we made out for an hour and they touched me in wonderful, delightful ways, still the thought of experiencing actual genital contact was just sort of like, yeah, I guess you could touch my vulva if you wanted to. Sure. Which is not what one would consider enthusiastic in any way, I think. I was just sort of fine with having sex. And when I listened to my body more, I realized that it just wasn't getting turned on. I wasn't experiencing physical arousal in ways that I wanted people to touch my genitals or nipples. That was sort of the line. Whenever I engage in BDSM or kink with like someone I don't know very well, I'm like, they're like, what are your limits? And I'm like, genitals and nipples, please don't touch those. That won't be fun for me. And people have suggested that I might want to look into the label of asexual, of being an asexual person. And while I am so, so supportive of people finding that label and being comforted that exists and that they're not the only one, and the label of asexual is this amazing thing that lets people realize that they're not broken for not wanting to have sex, it still didn't feel right for me. And I felt like I was having asexual imposter syndrome because I still wanted to have sex with people when I first met them. And I always want, I'm thinking about sex all the time. I read a lot of erotic fan fiction, like shocking amounts of erotic fan fiction. And I'm always thinking about it. It's pretty great. But when it comes down to brass tacks, when it comes down to dildos, I can't think of what it would come down to in bed. It can still be brass tacks. Yeah. Depends what you're into. Yeah. I just still didn't want people to touch my genitals. So I was really confused. I didn't feel like I was asexual because I thought about sex all the time and I wanted sex all the time and I masturbate. But I just felt very weird when people touched me. And then that got even more confused because for the first time, I think ever. I've had a partner for the last year now that I've consistently wanted to have sex with all the time, and that's never happened to me. Usually it's a couple of months and I'm not really interested in the physical aspect anymore. So I was actually having a conversation with my girlfriend just this last weekend, and I sort of managed to put it into words because there's been all of this conversation on the poly Facebook group that I'm a part of about being asexual and what does it mean. And I didn't know if I felt like I fit in, and somebody invited me to this asexual or demisexual meetup, and I was agonizing on whether or not I should go. It's actually been very relevant and recent that I've been thinking about all this. And I was hanging out with my girlfriend, and she was talking about the sad feelings she had about me not wanting to have sex with her and how that made her feel like I wasn't interested in being intimate with her, that I didn't love her, any of those things. And I sort of managed to verbalize to her in this very tearful, emotional conversation that it feels like my sexuality falls into one of three spheres, and depending on which sphere it falls into will explain how I should handle it. And when I say handle, it really seems like I'm pathologizing myself. I mean, it should be mentioned that I'm kind of distressed that I don't experience arousal. It's not, a lot of ace people are relieved and they're like, oh, thank God I don't have to do this anymore. But like I said, I think about sex all the time. I am a red-blooded American gal and I want to get some, except when it actually comes to getting some. And then I'm like, what if you didn't touch my genitals? That would be great. So sort of the three explanations for my existence are, one, that I'm asexual and the way that I experience arousal is fine because I'm asexual and I'm not broken. Two, that I'm allosexual. And allosexual, by the way, is the opposite of asexual. It got that prefix because sort of comparing asexual to sexual seems to indicate that asexual is the wrong and weird one, because sexual is the default. It has no prefix. So we added the prefix allo onto it to indicate that it exists. So asexual, large spectrum through the gray area into allosexual. So, sorry. One option is that I'm asexual and everything's fine. One option is that I'm allosexual and something's wrong with me, that I have a hormonal problem, or I need to look a little bit more into the dual control model of arousal and try to ease up off the brakes and find the things that are preventing me from becoming aroused. Maybe I need to take more relaxing baths, or masturbate more often, or try pot, or any number of things that can make me feel good. And the third option, which only recently occurred to me, is that I'm allosexual and also I'm fine. That we have this view of low sexuality, and it makes people feel good to say that they're asexual, which is great. This is not me ragging on the concept of asexuality. It's super rad. It lets people know that it's not weird what they're experiencing. But also, people, especially assigned female at birth people, traditionally can experience lower arousal, and that doesn't necessarily mean something is wrong with them, or that they are asexual, that they just happen to be a person who likes sex, but under specific circumstances. If it sounds like I'm rambling, it's because I'm still defining this to myself. Again, this was literally four days ago.
Like, just to add more things for you to contemplate, things that you probably also know. I mean, like, my first thought is, if you have sexual interest through the NRE, through the new relationship energy, and then it fades away, like, that indicates to me, like, my first thought is to go to like brain chemicals, mm-hmm. right? Like, so the dopamine, the norepinephrine, you know, like.
And I am on an SSRI, which can definitely affect arousal.
Yeah, that would be my first thought. It's like when we talk about what happens to relationships after like 18 months, right? And then people are like, why doesn't it feel the way that it did initially? And why people make the commitments they do at the points with that they do in the duration of a relationship, and how much of it is because they're effectively drunk, mm-hmm. like you're drunk yeah. on brain chemicals, and we continue to be drunk on brain chemicals for a while. Like when you show a picture of someone's long-term partner to them, the way their brain reacts still continues to be a little bit drunk, mm-hmm. right? You're like a little bit drunk on love.
Oh yeah,
even after the point of like the high. So you know, like, I don't think it's uncommon for someone to be like super interested and then like the relationship changes in form.
Right. I mean, I should also mention for me specifically, I will even sometimes have that NRE feeling and still be like, oh man, I totally want to fuck you. And then I get into bed and I'm like, but what if you didn't touch my genitals? It's weird and I'm confused and have a lot of feelings about it.
I mean, like, not that I'm going to try to solve this problem for you.
Yeah.
But I think about a previous episode we had. Jillian Keenan is an author who wrote a book about how Shakespeare has written about kink.
Oh.
Yeah, you should read it. You should totally read it. It's just listen to the episode. She's great. And her entire experience of sexuality is through spanking. Like, she is in a relationship where I think they do other stuff, but, like, what matters to her is the spanking part.
That's very interesting.
Is the TLDR version.
Right.
And we had a really interesting conversation about, like, what does that mean when, like, parents spank, right? So that means something real different when you take it in that context. But what her experience of a fulfilling, satisfying sexual experience that she inherently wants to have and doesn't just, like, retrospectively look back and go, like, that was fine. But, like, what she's actually into is just different than what we're told, like, you do this and then this and then this. And, like, we already know as sex educators that the baseball model is incredibly limited.
Boy, howdy.
You know, like, maybe I don't want to go past third. Maybe I just want to go straight to third and then stay there and then go to left field. You know, like, there's a lot of options. And we are still learning stuff every day. Like, the fact that you said allosexual and I had not heard that as the term before. My understanding on the purple red scale, as I mentioned, was hypersexual, primary sexual, demisexual, and then the gray A scale. So, like, we already have different terminology for this because this is an emergent understanding, because we started out with this binary, like, straight gay. And then we went to, okay, but maybe there's, like, a whole thing in between there or beyond that. And then we're like, well, that still doesn't even describe what you want to do with that person.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't describe, like, how important that is to your life.
We're in, like, a five-dimensional hypercube at this point.
Yeah. And then when we talk about asexuality and how that doesn't mean you don't want to date. Like, there are plenty of people who are romantically inclined who are not necessarily sexually inclined. And then the ongoing debate of, like, what if you were bisexually oriented, but, like, romantically interested only in one gender? Does that make you not a real bisexual? And blah-dee-dee-blah-dee-blah, nobody is queer enough. Nobody is good enough.
Oh, I have so many not queer
nobody
enough
Nobody is right enough. You know, like, it's the pulling forces of trying to be conformist and normalized. And this is what biology says. Well, what biology says is actually we do all sorts of stuff.
Right.
Biology says there's a great more diversity in the world than culture says. And then on the other end of the spectrum is, like, when are you ever going to be queer enough?
Yes.
You know, like, and how many same-sex experiences do you have to have before you get to call yourself anything other than straight? And just, like, all of these qualifiers, because we just, like, have to be able to label you appropriately.
One of the benefits of being appropriately labeled, though, is knowing how to feel about yourself or what to do about yourself. For example, if I decide to go with the label of a healthy, happy, asexual person, I can kind of stop worrying about it. But it also means that I'm a little bit limited in what I can do with my partners.
Why?
For example, I might date someone who's like, it's really important to, in fact, there was someone that was interested in me a while ago and I said, I'm not going to be interested in genital contact. And he said, well, it's my primary form of building intimacy. I really need to have sex with somebody to feel intimate and like I'm dating them. And I was like, great. And we shook hands and sort of parted ways after that first date. Whereas, and I thought this person was rad. And if I could get myself into the mindset, again, not that this is the ideal mindset, but if I decided to go for the allosexual but broken mindset, then I could fix something and maybe someday I'd be sexual and I could date this person. And also, like I said, I'm distressed about it sometimes. I have had long-term partners that I really desire to have sexual intimacy with that my body just, I'm like talking to my vulva like, hey buddy, what if you lubricated? Do you want to like do something? How do you feel about getting involved in the proceedings, pal? And it's not, and I'm distressed about it. So if people are excited about being asexual, that's the best. I am so stoked about it as a title. But when it comes to me specifically, I still feel some form of distress and I don't really know what to do about it. So that's why I still don't know what to call myself.
And like, I'm here to say you are exactly as whatever you figure out you are and make whatever choices you want to make in the situation, etc. But what I'm hearing is like that you're going to limit your choices based on whatever box you end up falling into.
I want to push back. It's not that I'm going to limit my choices. It's that I'll know what steps to take. I'm a really A-type, like, regimented, structured person. I've got a 5-year plan. I've got a schedule moving weeks out in advance.
It's like schema-driven.
Exactly. Okay. So when I figure out what label to put on myself, what it's going to tell me is, now what steps do I want to take What do I do next about this?
All right. So from a much more hedonistic perspective, like, I'm just thinking about the utility of discarding labels in the way that they can disqualify things. So the purpose of labels, right, is in a positive way, because there are bad things about labels, right? They can be limiting. Mm-hmm. But the positive thing about labels is that it is shorthand to explain to people who we are.
This is my jam.
And like, if I tell you that I am X, Y, and Z things, you know that I'm interested in stuff that you don't necessarily know about me if I don't tell you.
Right.
So if I identify myself as poly, you know that I'm in a relationship and that doesn't preclude the possibility of something happening here. If I tell you that I'm kinky, you know that doesn't preclude the possibility of things outside of vanilla sex, right? So in those ways, labels can be really useful. Mm-hmm. They're only bad when it's like, well, I say that I'm bisexual and therefore you mean what you hear is, well, that means you're not interested in me because I'm like genderqueer or transgender or something, because that's mm-hmm. like your assumption
that's what
bisexual means. Yeah. So I don't know, from a strengths-based perspective, I think it's just more useful for all of us to just be like, what do I like and what do I feel like doing right now? Rather than like having to be like, I've got this figured out.
That's how I roll though. I love having things figured out.
Okay.
Any of my friends listening to this are nodding, I'm sure, right now. I like having plans. I like having things figured out. I'm a very concrete, logical person. My roommates call me a robot. Like, I just want things to exist the way that I want them to exist. And so, mind you, I'm not discounting what you're saying. Using the label asexual has been really helpful in the kink scene to let people know why my limits exist. Not that I should ever have to explain my limits, but I might say, hey, I'd really like you to beat the crap out of me with a meat tenderizer, but please don't touch my nipples or genitals. I'm asexual and I won't get turned on. Mm-hmm. And that's a really great shorthand. Mm-hmm. And if I've been dating someone for a little bit longer, I'm like, hey, if you are interested, you could try going down on me for a while and I might choose to have sex with you. And I might be like, let's go have some cake instead. So it really depends on how quick my conversation with you is. Do I need the shorthand of calling myself asexual? Mm-hmm. Or are you going to settle in for a while and a glass of wine and I can tell you all about my finicky vulva? It's the title of my book, I think.
Okay, finicky vulva, if not the title of your book, needs to be a band or the name of this episode. Nathan, write it down! Nathan!
At least get the domain name.
At least. Finickyvulva.tumblr.com.
Yes. Yes. The URL. Somebody get it right now. Yeah. Okay. I mean, so it's funny for me because I have also been described as a robot and in such a, like, a different way.
Oh, wow.
Such a different way. Because I'm a robot in terms of being able to completely separate behavior from feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look at relationships that I'm even involved in from a meta perspective where I will voice the other person's perspective with the same vociferousness of my own. Like, in that way, I've been called a robot.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Because I, like, my investment is in an accurate representation of reality rather than my, like, anybody's feelings.
That sounds similar to my jam. I'm really interested in explicit verbal communication or written communication, but with no nuance of body language or tones of voice, getting people to specifically say the words that they want to communicate. I, in fact, run some workshops on explicit verbal communication. I do it with my clients. Like I mentioned earlier, there's all concrete, no abstract. I don't want to say what's their tone of voice saying when quizzing them about a potential client. I want to say what verbally did they say when you asked this? And probably one of the reasons it appeals to me so much is I am terrible at tones of voice and body language. And that's actually how I got involved with polyamory and kink. Because here were these social circles where everybody said what they meant and didn't. If I said, hey, you like patted me on the shoulder earlier and said, see you later. And, you know, that could be like dismissive, like, yeah, whatever, pal, see you later. Or it could mean that you actually wanted to see me later. And when you said later, that was like 2 hours ago. Is now later? Is a week later? Can you tell me what you mean by later? What's your schedule look like? When you said see you later, do you want to schedule something or do you want to try to bump into each other at a future event? And here were these people, these poly, queer, kinky people who totally rolled with that. They absolutely wanted to communicate as explicitly as I did.
This is fascinating because I had a conversation earlier with someone about why polyamory might be particularly appealing to someone who's autistic. Just because of that concrete nature, yes, and the fact that it requires that type of communication. It,
and now, mind you, so when I was younger and first getting into poly, this was the only group of people I knew who communicated this way, and I fell into it really naturally. And in fact, it never really seemed like a choice. I was like, oh, all of my friends who communicate this way are poly and kinky. Me too. And now, now that I'm older and I hang out in these like really great social circles of other communicative people, it turns out that a lot of monogamous people can do this too.
And plenty of people do poly wrong.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's be real on that.
I find that poly and kink are good gateways to explicit verbal communication, but they're definitely not the only people who are doing it. And so I too find that rather than saying that polyamory is inherently appealing to people who are to autistic people, I would maybe, again, coming at it from this disability perspective, say that the communication lessons we learn from polyamory are lessons that we should use when we're talking with autistic folks.
I think it's the culture of polyamory, yes, rather than the actual practice.
And I mean, there's a reason that I would say 80% of my social circle is autistic or neurodivergent. It is just a social circle of poly people that pulls in folks who don't communicate as typically as their monogamous, non-academically relationship-oriented peers.
Bam.
Yeah.
All right. So at this point, we have to start closing this off as much as I
wish
to continue on for 1,000 years. I told you at the beginning, the girl was fascinating. I told you guys.
I have a lot of feelings about a lot of things.
I warned you that this would be interesting. Okay. But yeah, so if folks want to learn more about you, because again, you teach workshops and if they just want to hire you because you probably have skills that apply to other demographics besides intellectually disabled clients, how do we learn more?
Honestly, emailing me is the best choice. I don't have a public persona online right now other than my burlesque persona, which doesn't really have anything to do with education. I mean, it kind of does because I do educational burlesque, but that's besides the point. People can email me at galia.godell@gmail.com. I'll spell that because my name is weird. It is G... What if I said that again? galia.godell@gmail.com. You can ask me what I'm up to. You can ask for my resume. I'll let you know what classes I'm teaching. In February, actually, I'm teaching a submissive 101 class at Kink Shop. So if you want to learn a little bit more about how to be a submissive or what being a submissive means, taught by a person with obsessive interest in verbal communication, come on down.
I love this. All right. Big nerd.
Yes.
I love it. All right. Galia, thank you so much for finding time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was an absolute pleasure.
This is dope. So thank you so much. And thank you everyone for listening. And have a great day. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timory. Sex with Timory, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimory.com, Sex with Timory on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timory_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.